Our next speaker is Darlene Francis, Assistant Professor of Psychology and Public Health at UC Berkeley and Director of the Francis Lab Virtual Link. She received her PhD in neurobiology from McGill University in the year 2000. Dr. Francis's work focuses on the bidirectional relationship between biology and psychology. Her research concerns the interplay between the environment and neurobiology, demonstrating that if you change environment, you change behavior via changes in neurobiology. Welcome, Darlene.
I feel like 20 minutes is highly unsatisfying at every level. And when Nancy first asked me to give a talk, I said no about twice, and then I got over myself, and then I come selfishly. I guess I've had an appointment in a school of public health for 3 years now, so I can't keep claiming that I have no affiliation with public health, that I work with rats, and I'm a neurobiologist. After 3 years, it's getting old, and I'm tired of hearing myself defend. So I'm more excited to sort of take the next 19 minutes to not convince you of anything, but really just demonstrate to you why I think the work that we get to do in these basic rodent models, I think, is pretty exciting and relevant for the things that we just heard about. And the first graduate course I taught at Berkeley in the School of Public Health was called Biological Embedding of Social Factors. So we talked about a lot of the things that you're going to hear in the next 18 minutes now. And inevitably, we needed a follow-up course, which we now call biological embedding of psychosocial factors, because ultimately we get to the sorts of places and questions that Nancy was talking about. I can. Normally I'm very loud and obnoxious. So conceptualizing social disparities in health and well-being, epigenetic calibration of the stress axis. And my training really is at the level of neurobiology, but I have a joint appointment at Berkeley, which comes with a lot of frustrations, but also a lot of opportunity to cross-fertilize. So my disclosure is that I, too, have nothing to disclose, for better or for worse. My name is up there, no disclosure. I'm going to talk about epigenetic processes, and I'll define what I mean by that later. And I'll use my some of my own research data and talk a little bit about the stress axis to sort of make three simple points in 17 minutes now. And again, these are my direct experiences as somebody who's bounced around a lot of academic disciplines. I quit graduate school, I was a social worker for a while, went back to do basic lab research, and now have this incredible academic appointment, which lets me do all of those things that I was interested in. And sort of my direct experience along the way was that as students and as trainees and as researchers, we often never got the opportunity to fundamentally reflect about how it was that we were even asking our research questions. And so I have a couple of data sets that sort of document my experience of that, talk a little bit about the developmental regulation of the stress axis, how I think it may contribute to inequalities in health outcomes via calibration of stress reactivity profiles, and again, epigenetic mechanisms as they contribute to regulation of the stress axis. And I'll leave you to define environment for yourself. We've heard a few variations on levels at which we can think about context or environment, and at the end of this, I would argue that these epigenetic mechanisms are still bang for your buck at all of those levels. So classic view of stress for people who are stress researchers, we kind of inherit this diathesis model. And you pick up any textbook and you read about stress at a very general level, and this is how it's framed. There's a predisposition of vulnerability by default. We all fill in the blank, and we insert biological or genetic, the classic, but we know it interacts with experience to ultimately result in a compromised phenotype. And so we can talk about physical health, mental health, a lot of exciting data now. Looking at cognitive function. I work with a lot of students in the School of Education who are interested in the achievement gap, not dissimilar at all from the sorts of things that people in this room are interested in. So the assumption, again, with this diathesis model, the inherent implicit assumption is that this has directionality, that actually this biological or genetic vulnerability is actually what's driving this function through time. And again, if you ask anybody in this room, probably hadn't thought about this, but by default, that's really how most people think. And we like to pretend that we don't, but after teaching now for 3 years across every department on campus, we really, really, really do. Really. And so if we distill away from some of this, this gets us at this classic nature-nurture. We all know what to say, that we know that it's both. We know that it's life is about the X and it's the interaction, but we really, really, really default to this. We really do. We can argue later, but we really do. Another way of framing that, again, genes by life interaction, right? And ultimately we get to this place where we still kind of fall on some side of the divide. We claim that we don't, but we really, really, really do. And again, in all of my classes, the students are equally split between backgrounds in social science or biology or neuroscience or endocrinology or molecular biology. And inevitably, every topic that we get for the introductory courses, half of the class says, I've never heard of this. And the other half says, of course, this is really, really obvious. And those sets of students never share space in the world, in the academic environment. So trust me when I say that we really, really, really still kind of default to this. I have data. So what I want to do for the next 15 minutes now, and we can flip ahead at any point to the end, I'm completely fine with that. So all I want to do is take this relationship and just purposely flip it and purposely show you how this function can work in this direction. So rather than defaulting to, which we all do, and certainly our parents do, this biological genetic vulnerability experience, I'm gonna document to you and show you biologically how we can go from a vulnerable experience through biological genetic means to ultimately get to a compromised phenotype. So again, if you're a basic researcher and you study stress, it might seem not critical the direction in which you think about this function. But if you're somebody like me who shares interests with people on this panel and people in this room who really cares about understanding social disparities, then it really matters what that direction is. And I talk to a lot of different groups, neuroscientists and psychology and public health, and people are really biased and people get really upset when you don't frame this from their perspective. So I just gave a talk in Washington on Friday and it was about stress and genetics, and people were really offended that I didn't list all the genes that were regulating the stress response, despite the fact that I framed it in this way, that I'm really interested in social disparities and social inequalities. I'm really interested in the role of experience in creating this compromised vulnerability. So people still get upset a lot. So I'm purposely going to flip this function and go in this direction, but so the assertion that social and developmental experiences play a profound role in the creation of biological, genetic, and I'll define the term epigenetic vulnerabilities, and certainly with respect to what I'm going to talk about with the stress axis. And that's not to discount that there are multiple levels of regulation and bidirectional influences. So I'm purposely skipping a lot of that for simplicity, just to show you mechanistically how we can get from an experience to the instantiation of a biological vulnerability. So I started working with stress models actually as an undergraduate, and this is the first intro slide, that stress matters everywhere all the time, independent of what your outcome variable is, right? So we can look at biomedical outcome variables, we can look at affective disorders. A huge focus now, again, is cognition and cognitive aging. So stress matters. I don't have to waste time on this slide to convince you of that. I'll go very quickly, very poor slide. Only a couple of things that you need to sort of take away from this. You need to have a stress response. This endocrine response actually is absolutely adaptive. You need to be able to respond to challenges and threats in your environment, and you couldn't live without a stress response. So you don't want no stress response. And this hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis is pretty well conserved across species, especially mammalian species. So sorts of things that Nancy were talking about, the perception of your place in the world and experience, all of that, we're not going to talk about the brain too much today in 15 minutes now, but there's so much exciting work happening at the level of the brain. But information about a stressor is actually integrated in the brain and then ultimately is responsible for stress hormones that are released from your adrenal glands, which you need to be able to respond to challenge, to threat. So that's all good. It does all sorts of things, right? So it does all sorts of things that you need to not to be able to go, not to need happening when you're encountering a stressor. So it actually fundamentally is shuttling sugar and energy to every part of your body. It's shutting down reproduction. You don't need to be having sex when somebody's yelling at you. Immune function, GI function, heart rate, blood pressure, all this stuff, right? So absolutely adaptive. What happens is when you have an exaggerated or repeated or chronic stress system, then this absolutely adaptive process becomes very maladaptive. And And that's the sort of thing that I'll refer to. And I'm going to talk a lot about one particular gene product in the brain, in this part of the brain called the hippocampus, which is critically responsible for the negative feedback aspect of this axis. So again, you need a stress response, you really need to shut it off, and the action at this part of the brain matters. Again, this is going to seem obvious to state, but this central dogma that we've all learned in school, whether it's psychology or biology or genetics, is that information flows from genotype to phenotype, despite the fact that we have data from lots of different fields that document sort of that that's not the case, right? Or that's not exclusively the case. So these are two different WASP products from the same genotype, just reared or grown in different hosts. And this is actually a classic experiment from from plant biology, taking plant clones and simply clipping them and growing them at different elevations. So again, anybody in the room, you don't have to be a geneticist to see that these clones are actually exhibiting very different phenotypes based on the environment in which they're cultivated and in which they're grown. So we buy that at the level of the wasp, we buy that at the level of the plant, but for some reason, we're really resistant to buying that at the level of people, which is why I work with rats, because imagine trying to convince people of this with people. And I did work with kids. I was a social worker, and I went back to working with rats. And after hearing the last talk, I'm sort of grateful for the simplicity of working with rats. So again, this you don't have to be a rocket scientist or a neuroscientist to see how given phenotypes interact with the environment to produce a particular phenotype. It really is that the writing is on the screen, right? It's on the wall. What about mammals? So this is work that I did. I did this all temporally. Not synchronized, but just to sort of give you the quick take-home message. So I want to do the same sort of experiment in a mammalian system, and I chose two inbred mouse strains that have dramatically different phenotypes with respect to, most importantly, stress reactivity profiles. They have different developmental characteristics and also cognition. So this is a really stupid, high-stress, I hope nobody's going to quote me on this, highly stress-reactive inbred strain of mouse, and this is a really calm, cool, collected, pretty Doogie Howser-esque mouse strain. And again, the classic way that these inbred mouse strains are used in genetic and behavioral research is we choose strains that have been inbred for hundreds of generations so that the animals are in essence clones of each other. We test strains, we find differences, and we say, well, look, these are genetic differences. And the very first paper I published as an undergrad was actually working with these strains of mice, and the paper said genetic differences in blah, blah, blah. And I've debunked my own work in the last 15 years. So we have a low stress, pretty bright strain, and sort of the opposite phenotype. So wanted to look at environmental regulation of stress phenotype, and I'm cutting through a lot of the in-between. And also, these two mouse strains have very different prenatal and postnatal environments. So in this strain of, I don't know if I can go back, in this strain, the mothers actually are very nervous, very anxious, have very high stress hormone levels, and so you can imagine in utero what those offspring are seeing, and also very aberrant, awkward maternal profiles postnatally, as opposed to the super mouse over here. This mom is calm, cool, and collected, so very low stress hormone levels in utero, and a really high quality postnatal environment. So again, you can see, you can design this experiment for yourself. I took embryos 12 hours post-fertilization, and I took, actually all the embryos were from this particular strain of mouse, so from the super mouse, right, from the Doogie Howser mouse, and I implanted them back into a prenatal environment that was either of the, we'll just call them good and bad, I hate to valence anything, but I don't have time, so we put them back into the good prenatal environment, or the bad prenatal environment with respect to stress profiles, and then after birth, we cross-fostered. So again, you can imagine a good prenatal environment with respect to stress hormones, or bad, and then a good postnatal environment with respect to quality maternal care, or bad. And so our predictions are going to be that, again, these animals are all genetically identical. And it's pretty cool, the technology to get to do this. 12 hours post conception. It's pretty cool. So as early as we can before a lot of the regulatory developmental stuff is occurring. So you can see our control groups are this control of this group here, and our group of interest is actually this one here. So the embryos that have come from this super mouse that are in a crappy prenatal environment and a crappy postnatal environment. So if we're going to hedge our bets, we're going to predict that we're going to find differences between here and here. And I just want to say now that I have a little bit more statistical knowledge hanging around, piling around with epidemiologists, that there is no, absolutely no power with which I could say anything more than the graphs that you'll see. So I can't talk about any interactions, and my postdoc was about to be over. So this is a graph just summarizing all of the outcome variables, but this is a simple behavioral task. Again, rodents not so dissimilar to people. You put them in an open field. Very few people will walk to the middle of the room. The more anxious, the more fearful animals. And humans will hug the walls. The chairs in the backs of the rooms always fill up before the ones in the middle. This particular finding has been reported a lot. So these are classic strain differences. So I ran controls animals in parallel to my embryo transfer animals. And typically people would report this. So this is the calm, cool, collected, smart strain of mouse. These guys are exploring their environment. They're going to the middle. They're doing everything. They're not fearful. They're not anxious. This strain of mouse sits in the corner. He poops and he pees. Barely moves, and again, we find these group differences, and we say, well, look at these genetic differences. So these are our embryo transfer guys and girls, and what we see is, lo and behold, we've actually, by taking these embryos and manipulating and putting them in different prenatal and post-prenatal hormonal environments and postnatal physical rearing environments, we've actually recreated what people for 40 years have claimed our genetic differences by simply, again, these are simple experiments to design, hard to do, simple to design. We recreated presumed genetic differences by just swapping prenatal and postnatal environments. So you don't have to be a geneticist to get the take-home message. I don't know how much time I have, so I'll go faster. Not dissimilar to rats. I want to look at now sort of naturally occurring differences. The experiment with mice was really to just be in the face of people who are really, really, really always looking for a gene that determines phenotype. Right? That was all 2 years of my life to just have the data to say these animals are genetically identical, look at what the environments are doing. So these are outbred rats now, so we're not controlling genetic background. They're naturally occurring lab strains that we can order. And this is a lot of my graduate work, and we were looking at naturally occurring differences in parenting behavior. And so for 40 or 50 years, in primate models and in rodent models, people have been manipulating animals developmentally, usually with the prediction that you do something bad early in life, that it's going to pop up later some way, somehow, and especially with respect to the stress axis. That's not so surprising. And so the model here was trying to understand how experiences early in life are again, sort of similar to people to the left of me, questions that they're asking at very different levels. So here we're actually now have the opportunity to look at mechanistically how we might get from early experience, differences in early experience to then these differences in risk or outcome variables. And I'm gonna cut to the chase that I'm gonna talk about. I'm gonna tell you that calibration of the stress axis is actually central to this. So these are four different, we can't quite see. We spend hours a day watching parent-child, rat-pop-mom interactions in the animal colony for hundreds of animals. Simply to identify what was going on within litter. So looking at the quality of maternal care. When we started doing this, we really didn't know what we were doing. We were just trying to identify what was going on. We would let the offspring grow up, and then we would look at, do all the statistics, all the regressions, trying to identify what variables that were occurring early in life were related to our later stress reactivity profiles. And again, this experiment came about from 40 years of data looking at using different models where we knew that perturbations early in life were affecting the development of the stress axis. So it didn't come out of nowhere. So this particular behavior seemed to be pretty potent and pretty important, which was maternal licking and grooming. And you might hear people talk about it. I've been in elevators hearing people talk about rats licking and grooming, and I put my head down and pretend that it's not my work. But it's rat licking and grooming behavior. And this is just documenting that across all of the litters, all of the mothers are being maternal, right? So they're all nursing their pups. They spend quantitatively the same amount of time with their offspring. Qualitatively, what's going on is very different. So we'll skew a little bit to the left. So we actually always have fewer low litters than high. I'm going to go very fast now. So I'm going to cut to the chase and say, I'm going to describe to you the animals as adults that were reared either in a highly stimulating maternal environment or a low. And, am I backwards? I think I can actually skip ahead and not feel so bad. So if we look at the offspring reared in these different maternal environments that were unperturbed, that we actually just recorded what was going on, so we didn't stress the animals, we didn't do anything good, we didn't do anything bad, we just recorded what was going on. We see that the offspring reared in this highly stimulating maternal environment had significantly more of this protein, this gene product, this glucocorticoid receptor in the part of the brain that's really important for regulating that stress response. So again, these animals are unmanipulated. We just recorded what was going on and operationally defined who they were in the groups. So this protein product in this part of the brain was important, but also at every level of the stress axis, these animals were different. This is just to summarize that they're different in a lot of different ways, but the glucocorticoid receptor profiles are crucial for what I'm about to tell you. So if we look at those animals as adults, we stress them for 15 minutes, and again, these are the offspring of these two different maternal environments, early environment. You can see that we see differences in a peak stress response. So this is a frustrating stressor for the rats. We put them in a plastic cone, and they can't get out. So it's not anything but annoying and frustrating. So they sufficiently mount a stress response. And then what I want you to take from this is how long it takes the two groups of animals to recover from that 15-minute really annoying stressor. So this is 15 minutes of stress, and these animals are seeing, these offspring reared in this different maternal environment are seeing almost twice as much of this stress hormone, which has very negative consequences at high levels or repeatedly. So already you can see how these developmental experiences are fundamentally calibrating a stress response that you would never even imagine. The game is afoot, right? So this all happened early life, and we look at these animals as adults, and we see these dramatic differences. This is the particular receptor. We do sort of all the fancy, obvious stuff. We do the cross-fostering to confirm that it's not the genetics that are driving this effect, but it's the active component of maternal care. And if we do cross-fostering, this is just showing you that when you sneak pups into a different quality maternal environment, that it's the rearing environment that's doing that. So I have 1 minute, so I'm going to do this. I'll skip this. I want to define epigenetic. I have a stop codon. I'll take 2 more minutes just to get to this. I have about 3 slides, I think. Mechanistically, trying to understand how you get from those early experiences calibrating the stress axis, but something that persists and is ultimately dictating your endocrine profile, your stress reactivity profiles in life when this happens so early. So again, we're moving a little bit away from this deterministic genomic view of genetic view of life to think about epigenetic processes. And so this is what's novel, and this is why I think this talk fits in this session, is we're discovering that, again, we all really thought that the genome and that our genotype was quite fixed and inert, and we're discovering now from using methods from cancer biology and gene regulation that really your genome isn't nearly as inert as we thought, and environmental events are absolutely capable of differentially regulating gene expression. A couple of mechanisms that I won't have time to describe, I'll just show you the graph. DNA methylation is one that you hear people talk about a lot, and it's very in vogue, and it just means that methyl groups that are available in diet, that are sources that are come from a lot of different places that you can actually drive differentially up or down, actually bind to regulatory regions in front of genes and are capable of rendering a particular gene active or inactive. So again, we're not talking about a genotype. We're talking about how these experiences in life are actually modifying the regulatory regions of your genes. So just even knowing that liberates you to think about how inherently plastic these processes are, and not nearly as devastating and depressing and morbid as we tend to think of these. So I'm going to skip to the end because I think that's kind of the take-home message that I wanted to show you, that these methylation profiles, these regulatory regions, were actively driven by parenting and the quality of early life. So DNA is not destiny, and I think I'll stop there.